Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and I am joined by one of the best draft experts for the NHL in the world, the one and only Scott Wheeler. Thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. I know it's a fun and exciting, but also a very busy time of year. How's it been for you just ramping up to the draft in a couple months?
Yeah, it's been crazy. January and February is really my busiest times of the year. I mean, certainly the week before and after the draft are crazy as well. But really, January and February with my 32 prospect pool rankings, which are now wrapped up, thankfully, that's the grind. It's the sort of longest hours that I work in a year. So to be through that and to have no travel in March, my travel really starts to pick back up in April, May for U18 Worlds and the Mem Cup and the Frozen Four and the Combine and all of that stuff is around the corner now. So I've got a little bit of a lull here in March, which has been nice to just dive into some stories. I've got like 20 or 30 features on some of the top kids in this year's draft that I still need to feed and sort of finish up, if you will. So that's what I'm chipping away at. Just before I hopped on here, I was working on a story on Michael Hage of the Chicago Steel, who's probably a top 15, top 20 pick in this year's draft, and has a sort of a really touching, also very sad sort of story. So just working on that today, hoping to get that done this week, and then we'll be back into travel soon.
I mean, that sounds awesome, and I'm excited for you, and I'm excited for that story as well. But maybe to go back to like a little bit, you talked about January and February. Like, what do your days look like when you're on that grind of, I think a lot of people would love to know, is like you're essentially a scout in a sense, although you're writing about it. What are you doing? Are you watching 50 games a day? Are you taking notes? Are you calling GMs and coaches? Like, maybe get us a little bit behind the scenes of what it's like to be Scott Wheeler.
Yeah, so early December, I start to put together just loose lists for the 32 teams. I send a schedule of when I expect the countdown to look like from the 32nd team right down to the first team, just so that our editors and our staff at The Athletic know when they're coming, so that the beat reporters who cover each of those teams know when their team's day is going to be. Those things change. Obviously, there are trades this year. Cutter Gauthier was traded, which changed the outlook dramatically for both Philadelphia and Anaheim, right? So things like that always sort of shake it up. And then from December, really right through till the end of February, I worked from the day I left for the World Juniors until the day that it was completed on February 28th, which was actually my birthday this year. I worked 70 something straight days. Like there's no weekends, there's no time with family, it's just that one time of the year where I really have to buckle down. And then as far as the process goes, it's a lot of phone calls to scouts, strength and conditioning coaches that I know, skills coaches that I know, trying to get updates on where players are at, their health, their training regimen, different coaches and general managers, whether it's their coaches in junior or their coaches in college, even many of the coaches in Sweden and Finland I now have relationships with. So picking their brains on some of the guys, sort of I send my list to people to say, hey, do you think I'm too high, too low on these guys? And then it's a ton of tape, right? If I'm going to do the project, I need to do the work, which is getting at least, I try to get at least two updated viewings on every single player that's featured in the project, which is about 500 players. So you do the math, 500 players, 1,000 viewings. Now, some of those I've already done, right? Some of them I've already seen play in the OHL this year because I'm Ontario based and I've seen the guys in Barrie and Peterborough and Kitchener, and I've traveled around and I've hit those spots. I've seen many of the other guys 20 times in the last year. I saw Lane Hutson live 20, basically 20 times, between international events, between a trip down to the US to see him play in college, World Junior Summer Showcase, all of that. So it varies for every player. The top guys I've seen a ton of, and I've seen them over years and years. So updating those reports and updating where I'm at on those players isn't actually that complicated a thing. When you have that baseline of where you're at on a player and where their game is at, it's just updating to say, okay, has he gotten a little quicker? Has he figured some of the problem solving and processing pieces out? If that was an issue for him previously, if he's a defenseman, has he started to make more mature decisions and efficient decisions with the puck and all of that? So the updates are actually happen pretty quickly. And thankfully, we pay for a scouting service called Instat at The Athletic, which cuts down a 2.5 hour game to just a player's ice time. So if I want to go and watch Cutter Gauthier play, I can watch his 20 minutes of ice time in 20 minutes instead of having to sit down for 2.5 hours and watch a Boston College game, right? So that piece of the techno, I wouldn't be able to do my job without that technology piece. I have a travel budget, obviously, at the Athletic, and I get to travel around. I typically make a few trips to the US every year, whether it's to see the NTDP or to see college games. I obviously hit all of the kids in Ontario that I need to hit. But then other than the international events, I do have to rely on video, right? So the Instat and being able to cut that time down, like there's not enough time in a year to get 1,000 viewings of these guys if I had to watch a 2.5 hour game, right? So that piece of the puzzle makes a world of difference. And then it's just that it's slotting them. It's sort of, I do 15 players for each team, and it's okay, one, typically there are 20, 25 players within that organization that I need to pay attention to. Which 10 guys aren't going to make the list, which 15 guys are going to make the list, and then what kind of tiers do those players fit into me, fit in for me? So some of it's easy, like you don't have to think too hard about Matvei Michkov at number one in Philadelphia, right? Like that just kind of happens organically. But sometimes it's more complicated than that, and you get into layers and nuance about things you care about, and you just have to trust what you believe in and what you think a modern hockey player should look like and where you think the game's trending.
And with that, like obviously you talked about like the prospect rankings of teams, but also like you just had a draft rankings for 2025, which is crazy. You're getting way ahead of it. But my question to you is like when it's a like in general, but also when it's a player in Sweden or Finland, how much of your evaluation comes from the eye test and how much of it is from what you hear? Just maybe kind of where does that land for you in terms of how you rank the players?
Yeah, it's a combination. Certainly at the end of the day, the list is mine. I have to own the list. It has my name on it. The evaluations are mine. The rankings are mine. But in saying that, of course, I trust the people around them. You have to take everything with a grain of salt if you're talking to a coach, for example. I was on the phone this morning with a coach of Sam Dickinson's. We're working on a story on Sam Dickinson, a potential top, well, not a potential, a very likely top 10, maybe even top 5 pick in this draft. When you're talking to the staff, the people that are around these kids, they come with a certain lens, they come with a certain bias. It's the same thing with their strength and conditioning coaches in the summer or their skills people in the summer. They're all in love with these kids. They're high on them. But I do still rely on those people. Same thing with agents. Agents are obviously tricky. And you've got to navigate those relationships as best you can. But I'd be crazy not to trust them and rely on them. And if they tell me that I need to hone in on a certain skill with a player or that I've got a certain skill about a player wrong, then I'm going to trust that they're right about that. And I'm going to go back and put the time in to either prove that I'm comfortable with where I'm at or to maybe second guess where I'm at. So there's a lot of that that happens back and forth with people who know these players inside and out. But at the end of the day, it is my list, and I have to stand on it. So I need to be comfortable with the decisions I make about who goes where. And I've got certain types of players that I like better than other types. And my list, it does differ for sure from the consensus and all of that. So it's tricky. I do think there's also a hive mind that happens in the public sphere. I think a lot of lists start to look a lot alike, and I think that's because people who do this job and do it in public are reading the work of others. And I think you can get into traps that way. I often disagree with the evaluations that other people in this public scouting sphere make about whether it's a player's skating or their head for the game or their discipline or whatever. I'm often sort of scratching my head at the evaluations that others make, which I think is important to trust where you're at and also to sort of try to build a sense for where others are at and where you might differ and what that means for how your evaluation might differ. So it's a constant process. I'm constantly reviewing old lists of mine to see where I was, what tools and players I tend to be too high on, and characteristics in players that have led me astray over the years and that kind of a thing. So I do players I was wrong about at the Athletic. I do that every year. I do reevaluations of my old lists every year. I think that part of it's also really important to study yourself and how you've performed. So it's a tricky process because I also have to do the reporting part, right? Like my job is predominantly as a journalist, so I've got to tell stories about these kids as well. And then you're into occasionally some hairy situations where I'm reaching out to try to speak with these kids and their families and their coaches, and those people have already read my work and read my opinion of them and all of that. So there's always a balancing act, but I try to just sort of stay true to myself and trust the relationships that I've built over the years.
Was that something that you've always had, is just that ability, you know, as a someone in the draft sphere, prospect sphere, to trust your gut, trust rather than maybe looking towards others and how they're ranking players and not maybe getting swayed over to other people's beliefs?
It certainly comes with time. It takes practice. It takes figuring out what has worked for you. It takes repetition. It takes learning about the game more and more every year. I'm in a better spot, I feel, now than I've ever been. And I'm a
Mm.
better spot. I was in a better spot last year than I was the year before that. And so that's been a growing process. This is my 11th draft, sort of doing this at least on a part-time basis. It's my 8th year at the Athletic, but I was doing it for a few years as more of a part-time thing before I was at the Athletic with McKean's Hockey and Future Considerations, and scouting predominantly the OHL and QMJHL for them at the time as kind of a regional guy for them. So it's been a work in progress. I also have just like I've played the game my whole life. I consider myself a fairly smart guy about hockey and the way that it's trending. I coached my high school hockey team. When I was in high school, I was an assistant coach for my high school hockey team because I've had concussion issues and wasn't able to play for the team, kind of thing, and was still passionate about it. I reffed the game. Like, I've been around hockey my entire life, so that's a big part of it as well. I've always sort of trusted my instincts there. I may someday coach my kids and do that. Like, I think that would be a really good thing for me and something I would be good at. So yeah, it's just it's a passion as well, right? Like, you have to care about it and you have to love it, and I feel like I do. So I'm lucky that way that I get to do something that I'm passionate about.
Yeah, no, I mean, we get that through the hours that you put in and just how determined you are. I have a kind of a funny follow-up maybe, is how would you write your own prospect, you know, like if you had to do a player evaluation of your own game back in the day, what would that look
Oh,
like?
geez. Great question. The shot isn't there. The shot has never been there. I've got really good hands. I think I use my line mates really well. I still play beer league on two different teams. One's a journalism team,
Oh,
with
cool.
a bunch of sort of older sort of journalism folks who've let me into the mix over the last few years. Sean Fitzgerald at the Athletic, kind
Oh,
of,
yeah.
or formerly of the Athletic, actually kind of runs the team. He's now with Post Media. So I play on that team, and then a team of like buddies my age who we've been playing with for a long, long time. I think they would tell you that I'm a good playmaker, good hands, really good feel for the game offensively, but the finishing is not there. I'm 5'11" and 170 pounds, and so I'm going deke or five hole almost every time if I'm in all alone with the goalie, and the sort of long range high slot shots typically aren't going in for me. So need to get a little bit stronger in board battles and through the shot, but the rest of the game is there.
Is there an NHL c player comparable that you have lined up for you, Scott?
I think my brother used Kyle Wellwood with me once. We had
Okay, that's I like that.
I play with both of my brothers, and the three of us in a group chat once kind of went over sort of who we would be. And mine was kind of this someone with who's just really relies on the hands and the feel for the game. So Wellwood sort of came to mind for my brothers. So I'll stick with that.
Is there a Kyle Wellwood in the draft at all that you see, like someone that you know
Ooh.
just jumps up out to you, is like has all the tools out other than maybe the shot?
Yeah, that maybe the shot, and Kyle wasn't the quickest player either. Kyle was the player who had to beat you with three or four dekes because he'd beat you once and then you'd catch up to him and then he'd have to beat you again, right? So the player that but probably the most recent closest example to that kind of player was maybe Andrew Kristall from last year's draft. He was a second round pick of the Washington Capitals. He was a first round ranked player on my board, but the skater, he was always never really played with a ton of pace, smaller guy, smaller winger, which Wellwood was. And then the hands, and it's the hands and the smarts that have carried him, right? So he comes to mind that way. Jordan Dumais, the Columbus Blue Jackets prospect, comes to mind that way. they both have a little bit of Wellwood in them. I think, but I would say Bobby Brink maybe a little bit too, although Bobby Brink with Philadelphia is I always thought a little bit more of a competitor than Wellwood was. Like Bobby's not afraid to take pucks to the net and that kind of a thing. I know Torts has tried to get more and more of that out of him too. So yeah, those guys sort of come to mind, but nobody really in this draft. This last year's draft had a lot of smaller skilled guys. This year's draft really doesn't. It's all D at the top, and then even beyond those Ds, a lot of the forwards that I'm really high on, whether it's Hage, who I mentioned I'm writing that story on, Liam Greentree, Michael Brandsegg-Nygaard, some of those sort of second tier mid first round forwards in this draft, a lot of them are like 6'2", 6'3", 190, 200 pounds. There's some size in this draft, which I think teams are excited about.
It's the draft of the tall men, right?
Yeah,
I,
and D really. I mean,
yeah.
there's 5 D in my top 10 and 6 in my top 12, which is, I believe, in 11 years of doing this has never happened. So it's
Wow.
this draft, I mean, Celebrini at the top, but after Celebrini, this draft I think will be remembered for the D.
Maybe just, like perfect segue. I didn't even have to ask. Just about this draft, like maybe firstly talk a little bit about Celebrini, and I know you've written about like kind of where he is for number one overall pick. Like he's not the likes of a McDavid, Bedard, Crosby, but where do you see him kind of going as his like full potential potentially? Well, I said potential twice, but yeah.
I think he's going to be a star. I think Macklin is going to be a legit star in the NHL. He's a better prospect than James Hagans, for example, for me, who's the number one prospect, the early front runner for number one in next year's draft. He's a much better prospect than Juraj Slafkovský and Shane Wright and Logan Cooley and those guys were. I think he's a better prospect even than the kids who were also very high-end players who went after Connor Bedard in last year's draft. So I think Celebrini is a better prospect than Adam Fantilli and a better
Oh,
prospect
wow.
than Leo Carlson. That's the kind of player we're talking about. I think he's going to be a point per game first line center in the NHL. He kind of has it all. He's 6 foot, 6'1". He's really built strong and stocky. People have actually talked about him a little bit like Tavares and Crosby, just in the lower body sense of it. Like you see him in real life, you see him around the rink. He's just sort of got those true classic sort of hockey player tree trunk legs. Really strong kid. The talent's there, the skating's there, the playmaking's there, the problem solving's there. He's a competitor. He's going to be a very, very good player. It'll be fascinating to see where he goes because there's obviously a chance at San Jose, which is he grew up in California, in Southern California. His dad works and still works for the Golden State Warriors. So there's that piece. And then the other piece is it could be Chicago and he could be with Bedard, right? That's not out of the question at this point. So yeah, that part of it's going to be fascinating because I think a lot of those teams are just going to take a D if it's not Bedard or if it's not Celebrini. But if it is Celebrini, I think, a foregone conclusion. I haven't talked to a single scout all year who's doubted it. There have been a couple who've said maybe you could wrap your head around, if you really wanted a D, wrap your head around Artem Livshunov or Anton Salayev, the big Russian kid. There are teams that are high on those two kids. But it's going to be Celebrini, and he's going to be a difference maker.
And you talk about Celebrini being at the top of this draft, but after him, as you mentioned, it's a bunch of D. Maybe tell the people that maybe don't know these prospects as well as you, like what these defensemen are like, and maybe what the next tier of players are after Celebrini.
Yeah, so I mean the D are fascinating because for me, all five of those D that I talked about being in my top 10, I'm higher on all five of those players, every single one of those players, than I was on David Reinbacher and Dmitry Simashev, who went fifth and sixth in the draft a year ago, and fifth and sixth in what was a very good draft a year ago. So that speaks to the quality of those five kids. I think Artem Livshunov has who plays at Michigan State, the Belarusian kid. I think he's got an opportunity to be a first pairing defenseman. He's a physical presence who has literally every single tool you look for in a defenseman. Anton Salayev is 6'7" and can skate, which by default is going to make him a very interesting NHL player. Zane Parekh is one of the most talented offensive defensemen that I've ever watched at this level. That's including Quinn Hughes, who I had in my top five when he went seventh. And you could even Cale Makar, who I actually didn't have at three where he went. I had Cale a couple of spots lower. But this Zane is he's up there. We're talking about an elite, elite sort of gift offensively. And then there's also Ziv Boyum, who is doing in college hockey basically what hasn't been done in a long, long time. He's having a better freshman year statistically than Owen Power, who went first overall, and Zach Werenski, and even Quinn Hughes. And you go down the list. And now, that's not saying he's going to be Zach Werenski or Quinn Hughes, but that's the kind of, at least for now, that's the kind of statistical conversation that he's in. So those five are fascinating. Oh, and then Sam Dickinson, who we touched on earlier, he's the fifth. And he's not actually ranked fifth, but he's another name in that group. Sam's a 6'3" defenseman who is one of debatably the best defensive defensemen in the draft, and has also really developed his offensive game this year to be a weapon on the power play. He's going to score 20 goals in the OHL, which is rare for a defenseman, and he can really skate at 6'3". So all of those kids have high end potential. The forwards are less exciting, and particularly because the probably the next two forwards, at least the next two on my list, are wingers. So the debate that's going to happen at the top of the draft, if you're not taking a defenseman, is going to be, do you take the really talented wingers, which is Cole Yzerman of the NTDP, who's chasing down Cole Caufield's goal scoring record at the NTDP this year, or Ivan Demidov, who is, outside of Matvei Michkov, probably the most talented prospect that we've seen come out of Russia since sort of the Ovechkin Malkin era, right? Or at least right up there with where players like Kucherov and obviously Kaprizov came a little bit later and developed in his early 20s. But that's the kind of talent we're talking about with Demidov. So it's that those guys are wingers. We always know that it's tough for teams to take wingers right at the top. They find it hard, rightly or wrongly, they find it hard. And then there's a three centers, really. One's Caden Lindstrom out of the WHL, 6'3", 6'4" center who plays a power forward game, can really skate, projects as a top six center. Some think he's going to be a first line guy, some think he's going to be a second line guy, but he's going to be a really good NHL player when you can skate and you're that size and you've got skill. There's a lot to like there. And then the other two are sort of smaller centers. One's named Konsta Hellenius. He's a small center out of sort of 5'10", 5'11" center out of Finland. Very intelligent player. That's the name of his game. And then the other is Berkeley Catton out of Spokane, who is again 5'10", 5'11" center. Very different from Hellenius, though. Hellenius is all about smarts and the way he navigates the ice. Berkeley is all about his skating and his skill level. He's a brilliant skater, dynamic on his edges, crafty with the puck, NHL release, all of that. So an interesting mix of two talented wingers, three centers who are really nothing alike each other, and then five or six D that everybody's in love with. So you're really going to, in the end, have a very good top 10 or 11 or 12 players. And then that, then you get into that second tier that I talked about with whether it's TJ Ginla, Michael Hage, Michael Brandsegg Nygaard, Liam Greentree out of Windsor. There's some good players that are going to go in the teens as well, but for me, it's crystallized kind of as a top 11 or top 12.
And is it like in your mind, like going through it all, do you think there's a big kind of drop off after the first 10 or 11 players?
Yeah, there is for me. The one player on the edge of that group is Carter Yakimchuk, who is a player who's in that group for a lot of teams. A big sort of 200-pound, 6'3" defenseman who scored 30 goals, almost, well, he almost 30 goals in the WHL this year.
Oh my God.
Has had the kind of season that players like Matt Dumba didn't have at that age. Josh Morrissey didn't have that kind of a season at that age in the WHL. Sort of the, some of the top names that have come out on defense. Morgan Riley obviously was injured during his draft year, but never got to that level. He's kind of at the edge of that group for me. I have questions about his skating and his decision making. He takes a lot of penalties, and his skating is a little sluggish. But Yakimchuk's right there. But yeah, I would say after that group of 11, maybe 12, if you include Yakimchuk, there is a bit of a drop off. I really like Ginla and Hage and Brandsegg Nygaard and Greentree. Those are all sort of legitimate prospects. They're almost all likely going to be very good NHL players. But it's they're you're talking the, that group of 11 or 12, you're looking at potential stars like first line guys rather than second line guys, or first pairing defensemen rather than second pairing defensemen. That's sort of the distinction there.
Do you think I mean it's an obvious storyline, but do you think Tidge Ginla could go to the Flames, and would that make sense for them in your mind? If you know, does he
Yeah,
play at all like his father?
It's not completely out of the question. The only thing about him that really reminds me of his father is the way that he shoots the puck. And I'm gonna do a story on Tej at some point, and I've talked to him about this, but he shoots the puck like the traditional snapshot, which we actually don't see a lot of anymore. All of the top skill guys now like some kind of like pre-adjustment release, right? That subtle curl and drag that Matthews and Bedard are so proficient at. That's becoming the standard way that players shoot, pulling it into their feet and changing the angle before they let it go. Back in the day with the Iginla and Joe Sakic and the classic shooters that we think of, all they did was lean into that stick, right? They were just powering through it and leaning into that stick and using their leverage to pop the puck off their stick rather than sort of curl it off their stick. And that's the way that Teague shoots, and he's got a cannon. So that part is interesting. He just like throws his weight into it and lets it go. And his dad very much shot the puck that way. Sakic's obviously Sakic and Brett Hull, and those guys are kind of the classic example of that. And Sakic was really the first one that got that really harsh bend in his stick. Remember when they started using composite sticks and he could just whip it? So Tej has that. Otherwise, they're different. Like, great, people forget, but Jerome was a power forward. Like, Jerome was even in junior, he was a fighter and he was a physical presence. And that was his game as much as the scoring was. With Tej, I mean, he works hard and he'll finish his checks and all of that kind of thing, but it's more about his skating and his skill level, and it's a little flashier than Jerome's was. So they're different that way, but they certainly shoot the puck. They shoot the puck a lot alike.
Last time we spoke about a year ago, the debate for Habs fans was, do they pick Matvei Michkov at five? And obviously they didn't. They went with Reinbacher. Just maybe, like, obviously the Habs have been very good at accumulating a lot of picks. How would you assess maybe their ability to hit on those and convert on those picks so far under the new regime of Gordon and Hughes?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very limited sample with Gordon and Hughes, obviously. I was critical, I've got to be honest, of the Reinbacher pick. He was a player that I would have more likely considered in the 10 to 15 range in last year's draft than the top five. Now, in saying that, I know for a fact that there were teams at 6, 7, 8 immediately after the Habs who were prepared to take him. So it's not like they were alone in believing in him as that kind of a player, even at the combine. In talking to people, I got the sense last year that he was going to be a top seven pick. So there are I was in the minority there. I was a little bit lower on him. I still think he's I think people often confuse you if you're 7 or 8 spots lower on a guy. They confuse you as not thinking he's any good. That's still to rank a guy 10 to 15 still means you better believe that's a very good player, right? So I still like Reinbacher. The rest of that draft, I thought they did a good job with. I actually think the Habs have drafted really well in recent years. Obviously, a lot of it predates the current regime, but Joshua Waugh was an excellent fourth round pick. Lane Hutson was an excellent second round pick. There have been some others that haven't worked out for them. They obviously just moved off of Jan Meshack, who was a second round pick for them. They just traded him away in basically a change of scenery deal. Philip Mayshar probably doesn't look like a first round pick relative to where he was selected, at least, especially you look back at that draft and see some of the success that the players who are taken out immediately after Meshar are having. And it looks like Meshar went a little bit too high. But by and large, I think they've done a good job. Caden Gooley's a piece of the puzzle now. Obviously they didn't draft him, but finding Arber Jacki and believing in Arber Jacki looks like it's going to work out well for them. They went out and traded for Justin Barron, who's become a depth defenseman for them. So there's some pieces there. Owen Beck, we'll see what Owen Beck becomes. I think Owen Beck's probably just going to be a good bottom six checking energy type player. He's shown more skill in Saginaw with the Memorial Cup hosts in the last couple of months, which has been really nice to see him sort of start to put the puck in the net and play make a little bit more rather than just sort of working and skating and playing that sort of honest game that he's always played. So there's a lot to like there. The big challenge they're going to face is they're going to need another top six center at some point, right? Like, you're not winning a championship, you're not winning a Stanley Cup with Nick Suzuki and then a cast of characters behind him. You need, if not another Nick Suzuki, you need maybe even a player who's better than Nick Suzuki so that Nick's the second line center, right? Like, they don't have that. And obviously they didn't get it last year because they didn't get Fantilli or Carlson or Will Smith. They didn't get a chance to draft those guys. But that's the piece of the puzzle that I think is going to be missing there is they need to find that either through the draft or spend big and like spend 10 or $11 million in free agency and try to lure someone there who can play that role, right? So it's not easy to do to find a number one center, but that's I think that's going to be the difference between whether or not this rebuild is a success for them.
Is it does that almost impact if they don't get Celebrini, what they do at the draft? Like, do they go defenseman if they're at 5 or 6? And what
Yeah,
do
it
you?
becomes interesting if like it's going to come down to whether or not they believe that a player like Berkeley Catton or Caden Lindstrom can be that for them. I know certainly there are a lot of people that believe Caden Lindstrom can be that. I think the Habs, I wouldn't be surprised just based off of the things that they seem to value. I wouldn't be surprised if they also thought that Caden Lindstrom could be that. Catton's a little bit more polarizing. I think teams respect his skating and his skill, and it's not easy to score 50 goals and 100 points in the WHL in your draft year, especially on a team like Spokane that actually doesn't have a ton of talent around him. Like he's doing it all on his own most nights there. He's led the WHL in shorthanded goals this year, so there's potentially some shorthanded value with his skating, very sort of Mitch Marner shorthanded sort of value kind of thing there. So that all that's interesting, but there are teams that don't think that he's going to be a first line center and that believe he's going to be a sort of second line center or maybe even be a winger in the NHL. So Catton, I'm not sure every team would be convinced that he's a worthwhile top 5 or 6 pick if that's where the Habs end up. And who knows whether Lindstrom will be available. I think everybody likes Lindstrom, so it's just a matter of how early does he go rather than how late does he go. I've got Lindstrom kind of in that 9 to 11 range on my board all year, but he's probably going to go like top 5 or top 6 at this rate, even after missing the last couple of months with 2 different injuries. And it sounds like he'll be back for U18 Worlds, which would be great both for me to get more viewings of him and for NHL clubs who haven't seen him play in a few months to get more viewings. So yeah, there's still a lot of balls up in the air, and U18 Worlds obviously always has a bit of an impact on the draft and all that. But no, there's some options there. Like there's some potential there to find some centers, even if it's not Celebrini. But the allure of the defenseman even still, and that's with a team that already has Gouley and Hutson and Rheinbacher. I wouldn't be shocked if I just took another D, right? So it's going to be a tricky proposition for the Habs, which is probably more of a case that they should have taken a forward a year ago, knowing that the D were coming this year, right? So there's always that in the back of my mind with the process. I think their process was maybe a little bit off last year. I know that they've argued publicly and privately. They've said that they like Rheinbacher better than the D in this draft. But that's hard for me to believe.
That's definitely going to be very interesting to see what happens, and maybe they get some lottery luck and the decisions made for them. You
Yeah.
ranked Ottawa as 31st, and I cover them in the prospect pool. Just how much do you think another top 10 pick, another, I think they have another pick later, depending on, where in the first round, but how much their prospect ranking could change from 31st after this draft in your mind?
Yeah, I mean it's certainly going to improve, or it should improve if they hang on to them. And obviously they've paid a price. They paid a price not just of graduating guys like Stützle and Pinto and Ridly Gregg, and like they've got a very young core, so the prospect pool doesn't tell the whole story there. But beyond that, they've also paid a price from missing on some picks. They used a second round pick on Ben Roger, who wasn't signed by the team. They used a first round pick on Tyler Boucher, who's obviously due to injuries, but also just who he is as a player, hasn't been able to live up to that, and likely won't ever live up to that, even if he becomes an NHL player. So there's been some misses there as well. And then they've traded a bunch of picks. They tried to push in a little bit this year, and it didn't work out, right? So yeah, this is the consequences now that they really don't have a lot coming. I like Stephen Holiday. He's going to get signed. They're going to sign him, and I believe he wants to be in Ottawa, and they certainly want him in Ottawa, and he's going to play in the AHL or the NHL and get an opportunity to be an NHL player. And he's a big guy with size who really thinks the game really well. Tyler Cleven's going to be an NHL sort of depth, stay-at-home defenseman. But there's not honestly a lot else. Obviously, we saw the debut of Zach Ostapchuk a week ago, but you're talking about players who are ranked at the top of their pool who are like Zach Ostapchuk's going to be a fourth line guy. Like that's who he is. That's his game. That's his identity. He's a rangy fourth line winger who can skate and get after it. So they just don't have the quality anymore coming. They've got decent depth guys potentially, but they really don't have the impact guys. So this draft is an opportunity for them to do that, and I'll be fascinated to see what they do with it. My guess would be that they're looking at right shot D because that's all that anyone in Ottawa ever talks about these days is the need for a right shot D, and there are a couple of them in this draft, including Yakimchuk, who I sort of talked about at the fringes of if they lose the lottery and they draft sort of 8 to 10, Yakimchuk's a guy who could be in the conversation for them. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what way they go with it.
My last kind of around the NHL and the Canadian team is just the Jets in terms of they've traded away a lot of draft capital, but how equipped do you feel they are for the future in terms of their players in the pool with McGrory, Lambert,
Yeah.
Barlow,
Yeah,
Salmonson?
they're in a good spot. Despite the fact that they traded away a bunch of first and second round picks at this deadline to kind of deplete what they're going to draft in the next couple of drafts, what they did in doing that is they got to hold on to those guys. I'm sure there were teams that went to them and said it's a first round pick, or it's Colby Barlow or Brad Lambert or Rucker McGroarty. My guess is that Rucker McGroarty was probably the hardest no of those of that group. Everybody loves, it doesn't take long before you get to know Rucker that you love him both as a player and as a kid. I think he might be an NHL captain someday kind of thing. So Rucker's awesome. Like Rucker's, it's impossible not to root for him. Awesome kid, got a ton of personality and life about him. And then he's a great, really well-rounded winger. So Rucker's going to play in a top nine in the NHL. Little doubt of that. Obviously, Cole Perfetti's young and still figuring it out, but I think there's a lot of promise there that Cole Perfetti can still be a top six player in the NHL. He's been that for parts of this season, even. Certainly, his minutes have taken a hit since they went out and acquired Sean Monahan and Toffoli, and that makes sense given who Sean Monahan and Tyler Toffoli are. But there's going to be an opening someday again for Cole Perfetti. Brad Lambert, I think, he's a bit of a more of a boomer bust player with the style that he plays, but has made a lot of progress this year and is back playing center instead of the wing. And I think he's actually better at center because it involves him in the game, and his defensive deficiencies actually aren't as pronounced at center because he
That's
has to
interesting.
be lower in the defensive zone and do more things. And then the bit of a wild card that I think Barlow's going to be a good middle six guy, but the bit of the wild card there is Lucius and just whether Chaz can get healthy. He's been through the ringer. You name a part of his body, hip, knee, head, shoulder, he's been through it all in the last 4 or 5 years. So he needs to just play games, and I think there might be a player there as well. So they've got a good window now where those young guys are going to push some of the veterans and push for jobs. And even if they're not drafting high, they've got 4 or 5 good young players coming, plus Sal Monson on D, who I think is going to be a player in the NHL. There might be some organic sort of injections there without having to go out and spend in free agency kind of thing. So they're in a good spot in Winnipeg, I think.
Any chance that McGrory is ready for the playoffs, or is that too much of a
It's
stretch?
interesting. I think he is, but the more and more I hear about it, the more and more it sounds like he's staying. I've heard both from
Really?
people at Michigan who think he's staying, and also people around the NHL who think he's staying, which is actually kind of surprises me. Because players in his situation, I mean, he's one of the best players in college, one of the best forwards in college hockey right now. Players in that situation who are that good at that level typically like to stay or like to graduate now, and especially for the monetary reason as well, right? You're giving up money the longer you stay in college. So that's interesting to me. The other part of it, though, is I think he might be the captain of that Michigan team next year, and I think he wants to win a national championship there. And he had the injury that he punctured his lung on a really tough play earlier in the year that sidelined him right until the World Juniors. So it hasn't really been a full season for him. And I just don't think he's in a rush, and he knows that it's kind of crowded right now with the Jets forward group with some of the moves they've made, especially if they re-sign Toffoli, right? So I think he's starting to look at returning to Michigan as the best option. So but if he does sign, I think he can play. Like, I think he can play. I'm not sure whether he'll play every day in the playoffs, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's, once Michigan's done with their push and they still have a Big Ten championship game coming up against Michigan State, once that season's over, I wouldn't be surprised if he does sign, if he gets a good long look in the regular season, and then he's either down to Manitoba to play in the AHL playoffs with the Moose, or he sticks around kind of thing and is a black ace.
Interesting. Well, I'm hoping he comes up as a Jets fan. Just last one, I have a fun question to end off. Maybe what's your biggest hit as a, draft person, maybe your biggest miss so far in your
Oh,
career?
I'm not sure. I know the Miss. The Miss is probably a player who I fell in love with by the name of Vitaly Abramov, who you'd be familiar with in Ottawa. I was obviously based out of Ottawa for 4 years when Abramov was playing 10 minutes away in Gatineau. I probably saw Abramov play 100 games, probably about half of his home games. They play 34 home games a year. I probably saw 15, 16 home games a year for 4 years of him in the queue. And I believe I forget where I had him ranked. He went in the second round, or maybe even the early third round. I think he went in the 60s. I had him like 19th or 20th on my list. And I think part of that was just ex overexposure. I saw him make a lot of highlight reel plays. His hands and the way he danced kids at the junior level sort of reminded me of Nick Ehlers and Jonathan Drouin and other players I saw in my time in Ottawa come through Gatineau. Obviously Drouin and Ehlers were both with Halifax, but I saw them play there live a few times. He kind of reminded me of those guys, and it just never clicked for him. He was with multiple different organizations, and it just never clicked. And now he's over playing in the KHL, and I think he's a second line forward over there, but he's still not, and he's producing, but he's not even a star first line lead the league in scoring guy over there either. So yeah, part of that's just, it's tough when you're a 5'9", 5'10" winger, right? Like it can be tough for you. Really got to be special to translate. And I've been a victim of that a little bit. As far as biggest hits, I don't know. There's been a few. I was really high on Adam Fox. Like I believed that Adam Fox was going to become what he's going to become. He was draft. I believe Fox was also drafted in the third round, and was a player that I had sort of ranked as a surefire first round guy kind of thing. Jason Robertson's another one. There are a lot of people who thought that Jason Robertson was soft and that he couldn't skate, and that despite his production, that his game wasn't going to work in the NHL. Robertson was a player I was really, really, really high on. He's now obviously a 100-point guy in the NHL. Those two guys probably come to mind. We're watching it with Stankoven. I loved Logan Stankoven, another kid, sort of second round pick, but I had him 18th. I believe I was the highest of any public list on Stankoven. I wrote then, as I believe now, that he's going to become a star, and that because of how strong and stocky he is, that it's going to work at his size, and he plays like a bulldog, and he's so hard to push off pucks. So those are some that come to mind. Fox, Robertson, Stankoven. There's been a lot though, and hopefully the list will continue to grow.
I was going to say those are some pretty good hits, especially for where they're drafted and to who they are. So you're doing some good work, Scott. Just anything before I let you go, anything you want to plug? I know you said you had some features up. You obviously had a your rankings for 2025. Just the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, you name any of these players that we've talked about, I've got something coming on virtually all of them. I'm working on a Sam Dickinson feature with SJ, my colleague at The Athletic. We're actually doing a double byline on that. I'm working on features on Michael Hage and Tijs Ginla and Berkeley Catton. I've got something coming on Cole Iserman. I've got something coming on. I've spent a lot of time getting to know those kids. Dean Wichtornow is an interesting one that I've got a story coming on. I spoke with Dean this morning. He's a 6'7", 6'8" center, which is pretty rare. We see those with D occasionally, but not with centers. He played at St. Andrews College, which is just about a 5-minute drive, 10-minute drive from where I live here. I grew up across the street from Sac. Played at Sac this year. He's going to Sioux Falls next year to play in the USHL, and then after that, he's committed to Boston College. And he's a very, very—he'll probably be a second-round pick, but very interesting given his size and his skill level. He's a good skater for his size, so he's a kid that I've got a story coming on. There's lots of that stuff, sort of stories. This is my time of the year to dive into stories, and then we'll get back into the rankings and all that, sort of closer to the draft and after U18 Worlds and the Memorial Cup and all of that.
Well, I hope you have a great time and, have a much needed, a little bit of rest, maybe not 78 days in a row, and then you have the grind up to the worlds. But thanks so much for doing this, Scott. You're so knowledgeable, and I really appreciate you taking the time and doing this.
Yeah, thanks, Alex.